Welcome to Open Minds, a Freedom of Thought podcast series, interviewing the people who bring courage and independent thought to the challenges of today.
I'm James Burnham. You're Andrew Ferguson. You're an FTC commissioner. I'm just a guy who has a law firm that doesn't do much. All right. So we've been friends for a long time, and I've had the pleasure of following your career for a very long time. And I thought we could start with just some like basic biographical background stuff. So first, you know, where'd you go to law school and what was your first job out of law school?
Hi, thank you for having me here. Alita, thank you for the invitation. Just before we get started, make it very clear, I am a commissioner on the FTC, but I'm here in my individual capacity. I speak only for myself. I don't speak for my colleagues on the commission. I don't speak for the commission, and I'm not here to address any like matters pending in front of the commission. UVA for undergrad and for law school. My first job was clerking on the DC circuit in 2012. So it was right before the big filibuster fight in the Senate about adding four Democratic judges to the DC circuit. So it was like the tail end of the like Republican admin law heavy DC circuit before that sort of shifted to the Fifth Circuit.
So you were gone when it shifted?
They were arriving as I left. The filibuster had been blown up. The Judge Srinivasan had already been confirmed, but the other three, they were arriving as I left. So the court was radically changing on my way out the door.
Who'd you clerk for?
Karen Henderson, who'd been there since the early 90s. She took Ken Starr's seat. She'd been a district judge in South Carolina. Was part of the like Reagan-Bush remaking of the DC circuit, which is what made it the kind of ad law heavy circuit that we used to think of it
and
as.
And when you were done with Judge Henderson, what did you do after that?
I went to Covington right after and practiced antitrust law for like a little over a year. And then I went from Covington to Bancroft, which at the time was the law firm for Paul Clement and Viet Dinh, where Paul was doing like his five arguments a year before Kirkland bought it and was there for like a year and a half.
Why did you want to move from Covington to Bancroft?
There are a couple reasons. Part of it was just sort of like fortuitous timing. Bancroft had an associate opening because every year they would lose a bunch of associates to the court that they were like going to clerk. I also went to clerk after Bancroft, and when I started Bancroft, I had the clerkship, so it was like they called it like the Bancroft Fellowship for people who are about to go clerk. There was an opening. It was exciting. You know, Paul very famously had gone to Bancroft because he refused to give up representing the House of Representatives in the DOMA case. I'm a conservative and Republican, and Paul was sort of like the leading, and still is the leading appellate light on our side, and it was, you know, seemed like a once in a career opportunity to do very heavy appellate law at the highest possible level outside of like the U.S. Solicitor General's office.
So I know next you went to clerk for Justice Thomas. Did you already have the clerkship when you jumped to Bancroft?
I interviewed.
I'm sure he liked it that you worked at Bancroft.
He didn't mind. I interviewed with him before I got to Bancroft, and then he gave me the job like very shortly after starting. And I was at Bancroft for like a year and a half and then went to clerk for Justice Thomas.
So what was it like with the greatest living American?
Thank you for saying that. He is the greatest living American. It was awesome. Like your audience probably knows this by now, but you clerk for Justice Gorsuch, so you get kind of what the general thing is. But, you know, he's sort of like a living legend in the real sense. He has like a personality is larger than life, but his reputation is, you know, he's like a household name. And it's very rare for anyone in our positions to like be around a household name.
Wait, and was Scalia still there?
Scalia had just passed away.
So you weren't the term he died, but the term after?
I was the term when President Trump won the election and Justice Gorsuch arrived.
What was that like?
The first part of the term, when it was just eight justices, was it was very collegial. Most of our cases were pretty boring because they were taking cases that were unlikely to deadlock at 4-4. You know, we had some cases that kept getting, I'm not revealing anything from the inside, the calendaring is public, but there were cases that were kind of like not being calendared even though they'd been granted. And then when, you know, so we, all the clerks got along like supremely well. our cases were interesting in the lawyerly sense. They were like technical statutory questions.
You mean like they were law? They were,
that's right. That's right. Yeah. They weren't social policy with 70 briefs. Yeah. It was like law. It was like technical statutory interpretation questions, weird procedural stuff. like a IP heavy because there was IP stuff that needed resolving, and those kind of divide the court seemingly randomly anyway. And so that's the kind of thing you can do with eight justices. But the, you know, our happy hours were great because we all got along and everyone was kind of happy. The election was the result was unexpected. It sort of changed the tenor internally a little bit.
I, for the whole country, perhaps. Yeah,
that's right, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably even more for the whole country than for our weird little, you know, cloistered existence at the court. And then there was the super interesting dynamic of, like, you know, the primary that, you know, you were involved with working for President Trump, but, like, who was going to get the seat? You know, all of us knew people in the White House, and we were trying to, feel out everyone for
information. Judge Judy almost had.
I know. I
know. She wasn't on the list.
I know.
Yeah.
And you guys made a promise to the American people, yes, so you had to get on the list. And then, you know, Justice Gorsuch being picked, all of us would, like, watch his confirmation hearings in the background while we were doing our work because this, you know, this guy was likely to join the place we were at. And I think the clerks are probably more into the, like, confirmation hearings than the justices, who all had gone through it themselves and had been doing this for a long time.
I'm confident they never want to see them ever again.
And then he arrived, and so it was, you know, there's lots of ceremonies, and it was cool because it doesn't happen very often. And, like, you know, the court just since 94 had only added two new justices, just Justices Sotomayor and Kagan. But since Breyer had joined, the court had been, like, pretty consistent. It is nuts. It had been pretty consistent. He was, like, the junior justice for 11 years. It was, you know, it's nuts. And Justice Gorsuch arrived, and he arrived with his clerks, all of whom I'm very close with now, but who were, like, a lot older than most of us. Most of them had clerked there already and then had, like, pretty interesting careers and big personalities. So, like, Justice Gorsuch arrives, his clerks arrive, and they're just kind of, like, causing mayhem. We had all been there for, like, 10 months. But then, you know, like, they calendared Trinity Lutheran after Justice Gorsuch arrived, the big First Amendment case. We had the first travel ban case on the emergency application where the court upheld much of it and 5-4 struck down part of it. But yeah, it was a super interesting term that changed really, really dramatically in the very last
months.
So
you're saying Mike Davis didn't fit in perfectly immediately upon arriving at the court?
Mike and I are super good friends now and super close, and he knows the story because I've told him at his 40th birthday. But we got lunch with the Gorsuch clerks probably their first week there. And three of them seemed they'd already clerked there before, one of whom I'd known for a while. And they seemed like totally normal. And then there was this guy who was saying, like, off the wall stuff, like, seemingly out of the blue, hyper aggressive. And we were like, who is this guy? And for the first, you know, like, 2 weeks, I was like, I don't even want to be in the same room with this guy. Like, he doesn't understand how we work here. Then after about a month, I was like, oh, he does understand very much how we work here, better than I do, actually, and I could probably learn something from him. And then I ended up working for him. So but yes, it was a lot happening.
That's great. So you went from there to Sidley, right? Talk about that, and then, you know, what that was like. And how'd you pick Sidley?
So Bancroft didn't exist anymore. It had been absorbed by Kirkland. And I wasn't quite sure what they would have wanted me to do at Kirkland, and so I decided not to do Kirkland. Sidley, partly because, you know, you've seen this too, but, like, you interview around after a clerkship, and they all, like, promise you, we'll let you do whatever you want. But then you can talk with people who are actually at the firm and get a more realistic kind of perspective on what they're actually going to let you do. And I wanted to do antitrust, but I didn't want to do just deals. I wanted to be able to litigate too. And Sidley was the only one that seemed meaningfully committed to letting me do both kind of traditional antitrust counseling and deal work and litigation. And I was only there for like 8 or 9 months, but they did, in fact, let me do both. I mean, I helped run deals and was also one of the senior associates on the AT&T Time Warner merger trial, which was, like, at the time, the biggest vertical merger challenge the government had ever undertaken. It was like a $90 billion merger or something.
Yeah. So why are you only there for 8 or 9 months? Where would you go?
The same Mike Davis, months before. So Mike left the court and went to be then Chairman Grassley's chief nominations counsel. And he'd asked me to come with him. And I was like, I've got law school debt. Like, I don't know what your finances are, but I do not come for enough money where I can just, like, do fun stuff when I have the Supreme Court bonus.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Which is admittedly a racket, but a racket I was happy to benefit from. staring me in the face. But, you know, if Justice Kennedy retires, of course, Mike, I'll come, like, I'll come help you do that.
Little did you know.
Little did I know. So.
Oh, sure, because, right, very next year, yeah.
Yes, that's right. So, you know, end of June 2018, Justice Kennedy sends his letter to President Trump announcing that he's leaving. And I mean, a couple hours later, Davis is on my cell phone going, "You promised." And I was like, did I? And so
I'm sure he had other words to add around that.
Yeah, he had plenty of other words. And so I went to the folks at Sidley, who, to their ever living credit, I was like, look, I'd like to do this. I'd like to go on the Hill. And we didn't know it was going to be Judge Kavanaugh at the time. This was before the president had announced his the nominee, with which the selection process you were super heavily involved. And the folks at Sidley, to their credit, were like, yeah, you know, this is super important for the country. You don't get to do things like this very often. You know, consider us when you leave the Hill again, but, you know, we're not going to get in your way. We think this is great. Go do it. And a lot of them were friends with then Judge Kavanaugh. So when he was announced, they were even happier that this was going to happen. So I left Sidley for what I thought was going to be like a 3-month, you know, grind, but I thought I'd seen these before. And, you know, we would confirm then Judge Kavanaugh and you know, hopefully move the court in the direction that, you know, you and I had wanted it to go. It obviously turned into something else.
Yeah, why don't you just talk a little about the confirmation process of then-Judge, now Justice Kavanaugh? You know, were you on the boat in Rhode Island where there was the incident reported to Shelton White House? I mean, just give us a little color into that insane process.
And I'm not telling you anything you don't know, because you were as in it as I was from the, you know, from down Pennsylvania Avenue. But the first couple months, it was kind of boring, which was helpful to what we're trying to do, because the fight was basically like a litigation discovery fight.
Yeah, but documents.
Right, in which the American people, quite correctly, had no interest whatsoever. And it was about, you know, Judge Kavanaugh had been in the Bush administration for like 6 years. He'd been very high up. He had generated a tremendous amount of like email and documents, and the Democrats, partly I think because they did want to read them, and partly because they thought it would take a long time to get through them, which it would have, wanted, you know, all of them produced. And so for the first couple of months, it's like a discovery fight, which I had just been doing in private practice. So I kind of just like ran it like a discovery fight, and it was great. And then, you know, the story breaks shortly after the hearing, and then it's just, you know, insanity. Like literal insanity, like, you know, huge crowds screaming at us inside the Capitol complex. And a lot of people forget this, but like even the first day of Justice Kavanaugh's hearing, there were like dozens of disruptions.
I remember.
And that was just over documents. I mean, those
sound like an obstruction of an official proceeding. Yeah. if it doesn't require evidence impairment, but I won't ask about that.
I mean, it was an official proceeding, and it was repeatedly obstructed. I won't account for the difference of treatment of other obstructed proceedings, but, you know, that is what it is.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we helped find the, like, prosecutor.
Where'd you find her? What's her name?
Rachel Mitchell, now the county attorney for Maricopa County. Yeah, she's, like, the prosecutor for Maricopa County.
Yeah. Good for her.
She beat a Soros prosecutor in a very tight race in 2022.
Good for her.
Oh, yeah,
man.
It's awesome. Rachel's amazing. The story about how she came to my attention was, like, I don't want to name who the names are, but, like, basically people connected to the Arizona delegation kind of thought of her and proposed her, and I interviewed her, and she seemed great, and then we interviewed
her. And Flake was, we wanted someone who Flake liked.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, we brought her up, and we prepped her for this, like, you know, sort of cuckoo hearing. SNL has become kind of a sad thing, but the skit
that is
they
the
did
greatest of skit.
The, oh my gosh.
It's so funny. I recommend it to anyone.
I watched it Sunday morning before church. A million people texted it to me. And at first I watched it and expected to be mad. And A, it was just hilarious from beginning to end. And B, like, not inaccurate.
No, and it wasn't nasty. It wasn't
BK. That's right.
It was like, and plus Matt Damon's like very charming.
That's
the whole
right.
thing was just
that's
great.
Right.
Okay, so you did that. And then you were in the Senate for a while longer, right? So
yeah,
you were not ready to give up or what?
Well, sort of. So that ends Don McGahn at the White House then hires me to come to the White House on a date to be determined once the clearance stuff was all done. Then the president removed Don from his office.
I didn't even know that. That's interesting. Okay.
This was Annie Talley's idea.
Yeah. Well, it's a good idea.
Yeah. And then I interviewed with Pat Cipollone, who wanted me to come join again. But there was this Pat's security clearance got hung up. Everyone's security clearance always gets hung up. But Pat didn't want us to start until security clearance was done because he didn't want to be like at the beginning of the administration where people would start and then there'd be security clearance problems and that can be very complicating. And so there was this sort of like period where I was not employed by anyone. I had planned to go back to Sidley, but then got this White House offer, which I had again from Pat Cipollone, but I wasn't sure when it was going to take place because I wasn't sure he was going to start. And then the day that Pat's assistant called to tell me what they thought my start date should be, I got a reach out from Lindsey Graham's staff asking me to come run NOMS for him because he was about to become the chairman. Attorney General Sessions had...
Davis was done?
Davis was...
he was going to go chase Michael Avenatti.
That's around. Right. That's right. Yes. Yeah. He had him on the run. He had to finish the job. I forgot that Mike Davis basically like got Michael Avenatti in jail. That's
well, Michael Avenatti got Michael
Avenatti. That's right. Davis drew attention to this fact.
Yes.
So I went back to first I did what I always do when I have career questions. I went to Justice Thomas and was like, look, like I told the White House I was going there. This job seems pretty important too. I'm not sure how to think about it. And he was like, you know, you're like a true believer in this judicial project. We need that kind of person in the Senate so that the White House and Senate are kind of in the same handhold they've been with with you and Rob and Don. And so I went to the White House and was like, I'd like to do this. And they were like, go. It'd be great. We want someone like that there. Go. And so I went and we knew we'd have to do Bill Barr because Jeff Sessions had, you know, left office. We knew we were going to do a replacement. At the time, we didn't know it was Bill, but then we knew it was going to be Bill. And they wanted someone with experience. And although I only had 4 months of Senate experience, it was a lot jammed into 4 months.
And then how long were you there before you moved on to McConnell?
Like 6 months.
And then McConnell asked you to come work
with him. So McConnell's longtime lawyer left.
It's the Abeg job.
John Abeg had been there for like 15 or 20 years or something. And then he left. He had a private sector opportunity that he really couldn't pass up. There was sort of this period where, because judges were the main thing going, because Congress was divided again, I was participating in meetings with McConnell staff about who to put on the floor, what the politics of it were, who we'd need to play nice with to get these things done. And eventually they said, we take Abeg's job. And I was pretty hesitant, partly because I loved the Judges Project. I first got interested in politics really because I wanted to help try to get Roe overturned.
Congratulations.
Thanks. But after clerking for CT, I was like, I get that the way this is going to have to be done is you just need to change the composition of the judiciary to get people who read the Constitution in light of what it originally meant and not what they prefer it means. I was like, I want to do that. I don't really want to do the other politics stuff. I don't even think I'd be good at that. The judges thing I sort of get naturally, but the rest of politics seems very complicated and sort of outside of my bailiwick. And they're like, well, why don't you primarily do the judges thing? We can, we'll work on the other stuff. So I talked with Leader McConnell. I took the job. A couple months later, the Ukraine call came out and it was clear.
It was a perfect phone call.
That's right. Perfect though it may have been, it was very obvious the Democrats were going to try to impeach him. And so I was like, well, this job just became something like very different than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, that must have been fascinating.
It was. The first thing, the day that Pelosi, the speaker went to, her podium, which is not far from where my office was, and says, like, we're going to begin an impeachment inquiry. I went to the office manager, she's like the queen in charge of everything in McConnell's office. And I was like, do I have a book budget? She was like, why? And I said, well, I think we're going to have an impeachment trial, and I'd like to read everything I possibly can about it.
Wow.
So we're ready to go. And she's like, well, not specifically, but like if you're buying it for the job, we'll cover it. I bought like 12 books. I just started like reading law review articles to see what the like consensus and most important monographs are and just bought them. And so then I read the transcript of every Senate impeachment trial. So from September to when the trial began in January, I was just like all impeachment all the time.
What was the dynamic like with the Chief Justice? Because you guys, McConnell was, we had the majority, right? Yeah, so I'm sure he was looking to you guys.
I worked closely with him
Did he use staff? I mean, I'm just
He had one law clerk. So he had two staff that worked on this with him. One was a law clerk, Meg Braun, I think her name was. She was super smart. Like,
God, what a great clerkship assignment.
I know, right? Yeah. And then his like counselor, the counselor at the time is Jeff Manier. And then his sort of like a probes staffer who had worked on the Hill before and whom everyone knew and liked. They were like the three people that, that worked this with them. And yeah, I mean, you know, we were the majority. And so most of the procedures, we were going to have a lot of influence in setting because we had the votes. But we worked with the Chief Justice all the time. And, you know, he took it like incredibly seriously, as he should. It was only the third time that the chief had ever been summoned for this, one in the 1860s. And then
was it Andrew Johnson?
Andrew Johnson was the first one. Chief Justice Chase, and then President Clinton, Chief Justice Rehnquist. And there are all sort, you know, the Senate is a body that's run on like informal precedents. They're written down, but they're not, law. And you know, the chief knew the precedents back and forth. I think the fact that I had clerked and sort of understood the dynamic he was confronting outside of our building as well helped.
I'm sure.
And it helped like translate a lot of like the weird Senate stuff to a justice who's used to thinking kind of, you know, very much like a lawyer and not like a lawyer politician, which is how the Senate operates. But it was interesting. It was grueling. It was grinding. It was a lot packed into just a couple days. You know, we were going to like past midnight. We went to like 3 a.m. the first day when we were trying to set up the procedures. And the chief, you know, at one point he like took his contacts out and had his glasses in because we were going so late. But yeah, it was super interesting.
Wow, that's fascinating. Yeah. Okay, so you did that until you went to become the Virginia SG. So talk about how that all happened, other than obviously Miara is becoming the Attorney General of Virginia.
So I left the Hill. Actually, to go to Jones Day.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, I think you were there at the time.
Yeah, I was.
Yeah, to go to Jones Day. I was leaving the Hill not for any particular reason other than I knew I didn't want to lobby for my career. And I'd been on the Hill long enough, and I was far enough along in my career where I was getting to that point
when
we
lost the election. It's not as fun to play.
Yeah, there was also that. I mean, you know, and you know, we had another impeachment, you know, in 2021 too.
Did the chief come back for that?
He did not, because we were not trying the president. That's how the Senate decided. So the president pro tem, Senator Leahy, presided.
I'm sure the chief was really disappointed.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I'm sure he was aching to come back.
Yeah.
And so I left to go to Jones Day because I wanted to basically start litigating again because that's kind of where I wanted to spend my career. But I took some time, like a couple months off between jobs. We went to Sicily.
That was a good trip.
It was an awesome trip. And then the last couple of weeks of what was supposed to be my break was this 2021 election in Virginia. Republicans looked like they had a shot. So I just like volunteered on the Youngkin campaign just as a like, you know, like volunteer campaign lawyer. And then we won. And I got a call that night from someone close to the Attorney General who was like, do you have any interest in being Virginia SG? And I was like, honestly, I do not. I spend a lot of money I don't have just gallivanting around Europe. I haven't made money in a long time. I spent the bulk of my like career either clerking or on the Hill. I'd like to go make some money. And they were like, well, give it some thought. I interviewed with the AG. We hit it off. But I still wasn't quite sure. And then I talked with Justice Thomas. And he was like, buddy,
he's going to keep pushing you back in.
I know.
And you still haven't escaped.
That's right. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But it's the same dynamic. And he was like, you know, Virginia hasn't been Republican in a long time. This is you grew up here. You were born there. You were raised there. You were educated there. You live there. Like, when are you going to ever have this chance again? And I was like, you're right. So the AG made the offer. I accepted. And that was that. But as is normally the case when I have some sort of like career thing, I go to the AG or I go to Justice Thomas. And like, you know, I've had a bunch of jobs since law school. I don't stay in one place very long, but every single job change is like super risky. I mean, you know this. Your change is arguably more dramatic than any of mine. Yeah. You went from like partner at a, you know, AmLaw 10 law firm to like running this like, you know, cool new thing you're doing now, which is law related.
Yeah.
But has very little to do with like the practice.
It's quite different.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so you end up with your little like coterie of people you trust to ask these questions.
Yeah, totally. Well, so then I'll get to, now we'll finally get to today. So how did you go? It's kind of surprising that both you and Melissa are former state SGs. I mean, has that ever happened before?
Uh-uh.
How did you decide to do this?
The recent Republican FERC nominee is also a state SG of West Virginia.
Speak more about this. I mean, yeah. What's that about? Why is that the way where they're finding you people? Like, there's no NHS lawyers in D.C.? Like, what's going on?
Yeah, so I think the state SG dynamic is interesting because it's, in the like scope of American history, it's quite recent. Virginia only got its first state SG in like 1999. And even that one was quite early. It was one of the earliest states to get it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a totally different job than it is now. But there is this like phenomenon that even judges and former justices have complained about, which was states were repeat players in huge cases with big issues in front of the court, and often had like local prosecutors representing them or county attorneys or whatever in these like massive cases of national importance. And the briefs were often—
like the Roe guy? You know this story?
Yes.
It was like, I'll never be overruled by two beautiful ladies.
Correct.
Or what did he say?
Yes.
He made some ridiculous
joke. He made something that probably would go great in a Tyler, Texas courthouse.
Yeah.
And in the Supreme Court was like—
dude.
Nails on a chalkboard. I mean, it's
yeah.
awful. And so—
beautiful ladies.
Yeah, it's insane that, like, you know, I don't encourage you to go back and listen to it, but you can listen to the recording, and you could have heard a pin drop. He's,
yeah.
like, doing a Texas, like, aw shucks laugh, and you could feel the angst in the room. And so this phenomenon where states are, like, losing winnable cases and are not getting, like, the sort of appellate representation that private parties are getting, at the same time the appellate bar is becoming super specialized, states started creating, like, appellate specializations, and they just copied the federal government's name for that, which is Solicitor General. And over time, this has developed into like one of the places that super talented young lawyers can go from like big law firms to get a ton of like courtroom experience while also benefiting either their state, in my case, or states that they adopt, as is the case of a lot of other people. And on both sides of the aisle, but particularly Republicans, the state SG offices are also the way that state governments push back on federal bureaucratic overreach. States sue the federal government all the time. They fight rules, policy statements. They sue to enjoin legislation. And typically the part of the government that does that for the states is the state solicitor general. So you get appellate specialists who also become admin law specialists, which means that they are generally pretty good lawyers but have a decent political ear. And they come from all over the country. Melissa's from Utah, I'm from Virginia, but like the state SG of Mississippi who won Dobbs had no connection with Mississippi. The state SG of Florida who just argued the big net choice case had no connection with Florida. They're just super talented lawyers. They were in the Trump, high ranking in the Trump administration, and it was a place to go where you can keep sort of fighting for what you believe in and, you know, get cool experience.
And what made you want to do this?
I had not been in a courtroom when I, you mean FTC or
yeah,
SG?
FTC, sorry. You know, yeah. I know why you want to be
yeah,
SG.
Yeah. So that's a good question. I did not at first. I resisted taking the position partly because the SG's job is so fun. It's like the most fun litigating job you can possibly
sure.
have. It's so fun. And I had like very carefully picked my little like band of men and women as deputies and assistants, and they're like the best. Outside of my clerkship, it's like the best lawyers I've ever worked with.
Yeah.
They're just phenomenal. And so the job was fun. We like won cool stuff. We brought cool suits. I got to argue the stuff that really mattered to me and then hand it off to someone else if it didn't. And then they got experiences. It's just the greatest thing. And the FTC, I was worried. I didn't really want to come back to Washington. I had done antitrust law. It had always interested me. Like I'd done it. That was my primary thing in private practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd done antitrust policy on the Hill. But it's like the FTC, it's one of the alphabet soup agencies. But at the time,
you guys do what, the internet or something?
Yeah,
exactly. The airwaves.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Broadcast.
Yeah. That's the FCC.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Right. And then the FEC does,
nothing,
PACs.
Nothing.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. 3-3 is still a decision.
Yeah.
But you know, at the time that I'm considering this, the FTC is becoming like a household name. It's getting a write-up in the Wall Street Journal every day because antitrust law and views on antitrust law that had been relatively static, I'm going to get some criticism
yeah.
for that, but it in some ways had been static basically since the 80s, or at least had been agreed upon since the 80s, were coming undone on both sides of the party, or both parties. And that was super interesting. And my time both on the Hill and working for the SG, as the SG working for an AG, had made me more aware of, A, the importance of doing real consumer protection work. I just had never really thought about it until I was SG, and then I saw how important that is to, like, the every American, you know, when they're screwed over by some fraudster. It's the consumer protection part of the government that comes in and gets the money back for them. Critically important to the relationship between the governed and the government. Critically important.
So the FTC is basically, just for those who don't know, it's basically antitrust, merger review enforcement, and consumer protection.
That's right.
So what is, like, your day-to-day as a commissioner? I mean, you're not, like, litigating the cases, right? So what do you do? Do you have a staff?
I have a staff.
You just go to lunch all day?
I go to lunch all day. Yeah. I came here from a lunch.
There you go.
Yeah. My office has a
DC people love lunch.
They do love lunch. They do love lunch. They love brunch too. I've heard on the weekends. Yeah. The FTC has been described by the court as quasi-executive, quasi-legislative, and quasi-judicial. And as many constitutional problems as that description creates, it's accurate in the following sense. We do three things. We decide cases as judges in our internal court system, which we've had since 1915.
And they appeal to the commission?
It's litigated in front of ALJs. The commission sits as the appellate court. And then you get very deferential review from the DC Circuit.
Got it.
We enforce the antitrust and consumer protection laws. We do rulemakings. We do more rulemakings than I think we probably should, but that has always been part of the FTC's docket, is that there's a series of statutes that authorize and instruct the FTC to make rules. And so that's kind of the sum and substance.
And so what are the dynamics like among the commissioners? And in particular, I know we're all very angry at Lina Khan, because I read about it a lot. And I was just curious, like, how does perception match reality? What's it been like getting there? It was just Democrats for quite a while, right?
More than a year, I think.
Yeah. So, you know.
They were, so.
Are you guys all screaming at each other?
No, not at all. Yeah. I mean, so you've heard this all the time, too, because you clerked for one. But the justices are fond of saying, like, we get along great. My experience was that interpersonally among them, that's actually generally true.
Totally.
That's also true of us. We talk to each other basically at least once a week. All of us have, like, scheduled phone calls with the other where we sort of catch up, you know, talk about personal lives, talk about things happening at the commission that matter to us, talk about dissents we might have just written where someone wants to, like, talk about it a little bit more, because generally if you write a dissent, it's on an issue that's probably going to come back in some way, and there's always, you know, we're trying to convince each other.
The most important vote is the next vote. Isn't that McConnell's
old saying? That's exactly right. So personally, you know, get along really well. Our staff seemed to get along really well. Everyone was super welcoming of me when I got there. And I know that for a certain part of the economy, Lina Khan, the chair, is kind of like a boogeyman. I get along with her great. She, in her, you know, got dinner. She's really, really nice. You know, she has very firm beliefs on stuff. I actually, makes me like her more. If there's one criticism of Washington that I think a lot of us who are true believers in whatever we believe in have, it's the number of sort of, like, unapologetic mercenaries who don't really believe anything except trying to maximize the system for their own benefit. Chair Khan believes what she says. This is not a ruse. This is not with the ambition of getting a fancy GC job or big law job at the end. She believes this stuff.
I don't know that her relationship with corporate, the way she has acted, does not suggest she is playing for the general counsel job at Facebook.
No, I don't
or
think
whatever.
So.
Which I agree with you. I mean, there's a lot of people in this town that are just total hacks.
That's right.
And so it's good. It's good to hear. So, all right. So let's do a little substance then, because I don't want to keep you here all day. So just, like, at a basic level. So I went to the University of Chicago. I took antitrust from Richard Epstein. You know, Robert Bork, we have, like, a bust of him in my house. We don't actually have a bust of him in my house, but we might have. But at the same time, you know, Justice Holmes said, and I totally agree with this, the life of the law has not been logic, it's been experience. And it's now been many decades since the antitrust paradox came out. A lot has changed. The economy's changed. And I got to figure out what the rest of this question is. it's easy. In your view, where is antitrust law kind of today, generally? Where is it going? I mean, is it enough still to just read Robert Bork's book and you'll have all the answers? Or what do we think?
So this is part of why I wanted to become why I said yes to Leader McConnell's offer to recommend me to the White House. To explain why this, like, debate is so interesting and where I think it's going, I want to go back real quick. So antitrust law before Judge Bork writes his book is, like, a little bit, like, internally incoherent. I think there are a lot of reasons for that. One of them was that the statutes are not paragons of clarity. And then part of that, I think, had to do with sort of the how the judiciary up into the 70s was understanding its role. And then Judge Bork writes this, like, massive book. It's probably the single most influential monograph in American legal history because he basically rewrote an entire area of the law by himself in one book. It's like a like will to power. Like, it's unbelievable, the sort of thing that he did. And so we go from a sort of multivariate version of antitrust where courts are considering all sorts of things and deciding whether the antitrust laws have been violated by a particular, you know, like agreement or merger, to what we today call, and I'm hesitant to use this term because it means a lot of things to different people, but the consumer welfare standard. And that generally stated, it elevates price and output as the principal considerations of antitrust. If an agreement between two competitors or a merger between competitors or even non-competitors is unlikely to lead to increases in prices or decreases in output, then under the, and I'm generalizing here big time, and for anyone listening to this, I recognize it's more complicated than I'm making it. I'm just trying to make a point.
You can leave your comments in the bottom.
Yeah, exactly, right. Yeah, yeah.
Like
and subscribe.
I promise we'll read them all.
But, you know, even combinations among competitors, the Judge Bork's view of this would say if it doesn't affect consumer welfare by increasing their prices or decreasing output, they shouldn't be of particular concern to the antitrust laws. They might be concerns under other legal regimes, but the antitrust laws probably shouldn't have anything to say about them. This revolutionized how courts see antitrust laws for a couple reasons. One, by the 1970s, the country was searching for a way to cabin judicial restraint. Judges were sort of just like ruling the country with, like, you know, busing orders and stuff. In some places, they were literally running entire cities. And the country was searching for something that would constrain judicial discretion. The sort of economics first version of antitrust offers an objective sounding restraint, which is we will apply basically economic science to these antitrust questions, and we can get objective answers both that will constrain enforcers and allow us to measure whether judges got it right when they either blocked a merger or forbade a particular combination. One of the, like, interesting things about this is both parties ended up agreeing on this. Like, you know, for all the lamenting of the absence of bipartisanship in Washington, there was bipartisan consensus on antitrust basically from the 1980s onward, which is we consider price and output effects primarily. We consider other things too, like innovation, consumer choice, quality, but things that have some sort of relation to price and output. And that's sort of our, like, lodestar in antitrust. And it has the benefit of seeming sort of like internally coherent. Fast forward to just a couple years ago, beginning in the 2010s, there's this group on the left that we now call the, like, neo-Brandeisians. And they take the view that this version of antitrust doesn't sufficiently account for other concerns the antitrust law should address, like the political and social effects of large combinations of power in the private sector, effects on labor, things that the post-antitrust paradox version of antitrust didn't really take directly into account. And they start agitating for sort of like a return to pre-Bork antitrust. It's actually, they have a more complicated version of antitrust than that. But they call themselves neo-Brandeisians because then, before he became a justice, Brandeis was an advisor to Woodrow Wilson on antitrust and had a very particular way of viewing antitrust. And so they start agitating on the left, but the consensus is on the left and the right is really strong. And they make a lot of headway in the journals and in certain corners of the internet, but are not making a ton of headway kind of in the ruling clique of the Democratic Party.
A lot of Obama people who were looking for general counsel positions at big companies on the backside.
You got
for
it.
What it's worth.
That's right.
And they're all there now.
Yes, they are.
Doing a great job.
They are, yes, overseeing their large combinations.
Yes.
Almost coincidentally, on the right, views on antitrust begin to change because of the sort of surge of populism that...
Almost accidentally is probably an understatement.
Yeah.
Understatement.
Unrelatedly, I'll
yes,
say.
Yes, yes.
It wasn't...
We had a well-thought-out... The Neo-Borkians.
Yes, that's right. The Neo-Brandeisians have a, like, real political economy objection to antitrust. the populists, sort of, but it's almost more cultural.
Yeah.
And look, like, I'm, you know, Scots Irish family that's been here for centuries. I don't like anyone big telling me what to do. I don't like big Wall Street telling me what to do. I don't like K Street telling me what to do. I don't like Pennsylvania Avenue telling me what to do. And that sort of, like, sort of populist fervor is fulminating within the Republican Party. And President Trump, I don't think he was responsible for it, but he was one of the first to, like, realize what this was. And that is leading to some people to change views on antitrust. And the example I give is I can remember biking into Washington. I lived in Old Town during my clerkship, and I would often bike in, listening to the news on the way in to clerk one morning, and President Trump was, like, giving speeches about antitrust policy and promoting enforcement.
Yeah.
And, like, as a Republican, I was like, what's happening? Like, he's calling for antitrust suits against, like, Amazon, like, these big, hyper-efficient businesses. What's going on? And I think it was a recognition that there were a lot of people in the economy and in America who didn't have, like, sophisticated thoughts about antitrust law, but understood a lot of these businesses seem to wield an incredible amount of power. And I don't know exactly why that is, but it seems like a problem. And my sort of encounter with this was 2020, after the George Floyd riots, where businesses were taking very aggressive public positions on policy questions about qualified immunity, prison sentences, police policy. It had nothing to do with their businesses.
And they were colluding to do it. Right?
And they were taking the All-Star game out of Atlanta. They were boycotting states because of their election laws. And I remember going, what's happening? Why do they care about this stuff? I thought that they were supposed to make profits, make widgets profitably and efficiently to benefit the common good. Why am I having general counsels call me while I'm working for Leader McConnell advocating for a position on qualified immunity? What is happening here? And I think what I was sensing was what other people had sort of been intuiting, which is private aggregations of power that have a lot of economic power can wield that economic power to accomplish social, political, and cultural ends. And that seems kind of scary. And I will admit, like, by 2020, I was like, this is kind of scary, actually. You know, the sort of orthodoxy on our side for a long time had been the big government is bad. And that is still true. I think we all still agree on that. Big government is bad. It's dangerous. It's inimical to the Republican experiment. You know, human liberty is necessary to help achieve human flourishing, and big government gets in the way of that. We all agree. The other view had been, we don't need to worry about big aggregations of private power because that's just humans wielding their liberty. And the fact that they're doing it in combination with each other shouldn't really concern us. And I think that, you know, I'd started to become concerned on the Hill dealing with these big businesses and kind of how nakedly they lobbied for regulations that would insulate themselves from competition. But by 2020, I was like, I get the danger to human flourishing and to individual liberty that big aggregations of private power can pose. It's not the same as the government. I'm not equating them. It's not as coercive as the government by any means, but it also isn't always good or morally neutral.
So actually, I'm going to do these a little bit out of order. So, because that made me think of something. So I don't know if you're familiar. There's a professor named Daniel Crane at Michigan who wrote an article. He's written a lot of stuff, but he wrote an article called Fascism and Monopoly. And in that article, and I want to quote it so I don't misquote him, this is from his abstract. He reviews the historical materials and he argues that, quote, the extreme concentration of market power during the Weimar period enabled Hitler to seize and control totalitarian power through a variety of mechanisms. And what made me think of that was you were talking about government power and high concentration. You know, there's the Murphy case, or I forget what it's called now, but the case about the government bullying the social media companies into suppressing various viewpoints about COVID, which I found to be unbelievably scandalous, especially when the schools shut down. And I mean, I have little kids and all of that. What do you think? I mean, does this scholarship tell us anything? Is there something we can learn from that as we try to think through the antitrust problems of today? Or what are your views?
Yeah, so I've read a lot of Professor Crane's stuff. He also has, he wrote a interesting blog post about the non-compete rule that the commission just addressed.
Interesting.
Yeah, he's a talented guy. So without addressing that argument specifically, you know, I said this in my confirmation hearing when I was talking about the Murthy case, and I think it's true, which is there's a long history, not just in the United States, but in the United States, of government working with large businesses to accomplish shared objectives, even if those shared objectives are not consistent with human flourishing and human liberty. and individual liberty. And the concern that I have is if you have a market that has a very small number of hyper-efficient suppliers, it is easier for the government to control you and me, the individual, downstream in that market, if they only have to coerce a couple suppliers to then control our behavior. And, you know, Virginia was an amicus in the Murthy case, and so, you know, I've participated in this litigation, and I don't, you know, the states would have to prove their case if the Supreme Court lets the case continue forward. But the sort of thing, the concern that Murthy raises, which is the government either coercing by threatening to take, you know, threatening to retaliate against a business if it doesn't do something, or cooperating, colluding with a business because they conclude it's in their mutual interest, given their large size, to like control the conduct of the individual, even though that is like, you know, private power in a meaningful way, it still is inconsistent with human flourishing and with the individual liberty we need to achieve the human flourishing if we're just being directed by the government through their lackeys in a market. And I think that that is a decent argument that one can make in favor of an anti-consolidation principle as necessary to like Republican virtue.
Yeah, I mean, it would seem to me, I mean, COVID is just to me the best example, because a very small number of companies, and that was before Elon had bought Twitter, and I don't think the country should have to depend on a crazy guy from South Africa buying one of the social media companies, as much as I love the guy.
Eccentric,
whatever, you know, iconoclastic. Anyhow. They were able to
edgy,
yes, able to basically suppress the whole debate. Right. And I mean, and that had incredibly terrible effect. I mean, kids were locked up. We had to sue Loudoun County about masking.
That's right.
You know, after Youngkin had won the election, it was crazy.
Yep.
how much distortive power they had over the democracy. So I guess maybe I'm just violently agreeing.
Is
that something the antitrust laws maybe would have something to say about, or we're not sure? We need to, you know, what do you think?
So I think. I think the answer is maybe, but I think that the principle. Look, you and I are lawyers first,
yeah.
And our sort of like theory about how one does law is originalism, which is mm-hmm. when law is written, you look at written text and you try to adduce its meaning. And the way we adduce its meaning is the meaning is whatever meaning it was understood to have when it was adopted. Otherwise, it's just like advice to judges and enforcers about what to do in the future. But we reduce it to a particular meaning. And I think for the Sherman Act, the Clayton Act, and the other sort of like, older but capacious laws that the antitrust enforces enforce, the question I don't think that should be governing any particular decision is what would a coherent antitrust policy look like? That's Congress's call. It's what do these laws mean and what do they have to say about the question in front of us? And I think, you know, the subtitle of Judge Bork's book was A Policy at Odds with Itself. But I think, you know, it's within Congress's kin to adopt a series of laws that might create some incoherence in their policy. I don't think it generally should be up to the enforcers and the judges to lend coherence where Congress has, you know, competing values that it has at stake. Does that mean that Judge Bork got the antitrust laws incorrect? Not necessarily, but what I think it means is the argument I hear in favor of the consumer welfare standard most often is not this is what the Sherman Act was originally understood to mean. It was we need an objective standard to measure our antitrust policy and this gives us it. And my response is if I were coming up sort of afresh with an antitrust policy, I would want it to be objective. We're lawyers. We have an intense rationalizing interest. We like internal coherence and we're very uncomfortable with things that don't operate syllogistically. That is not how laws are written. It's never been how laws are written. Laws are written to address particular problems at particular times, and they lay down principles to address those problems. But those principles, especially when you have multiple laws passed at different times addressing similar subject matter, but done by different Congresses to address different situations, are not always going to be internally coherent. And I don't think it's consistent with our constitutional structure for judges and enforcers to say, look, the original meaning might lend itself to some internal coherence, we will create the coherence ourselves. And so I think that the first question judges and enforcers should ask in antitrust cases is the same one that they ask in every other case, and that you and I sort of de rigueur would ask in a due process case.
Always de rigueur.
Yeah, always. But, you know, like, this is commonplace when you and I talk about almost any other area of the law, right? It's like, well, what did this thing we're arguing about, what was it understood to mean? With the Equal Protection Clause, the Due Process Clause, Privileges or Immunities Clause, like, that's the debate we have all the time. That is not generally the debate we have when we talk about the antitrust laws. We generally say, what do the economists have to say about that? If relying on economics basically alone to answer antitrust cases is what Congress was laying down, we should keep doing it. But I think that for every judge and every enforcer, the first question has to be, what did this law I'm being asked to interpret mean? What is the principle it laid down, and how does that apply to this particular case? And even if there's some internal incoherence in the law, like, for example, the Sherman Act, as we currently understand it, and the Robinson-Patman Act, which are difficult to their policies are difficult to reconcile, I don't think that it's up to the other two branches of government to sort of lend it coherence. If the incoherence is a problem, Congress needs to address it, because that's how we govern ourselves, is through Congress.
Okay, that's interesting. I want to ask you about another modern economic development that I personally find very interesting, and, you know, say as much or as little as you can. So that's institutional asset managers. So, you know, I'm not an expert on this history, but my sort of general sense is that over the last couple decades, the rise in sort of Americans who own stock has gone up a lot. And most people don't want it. They don't know. They're not going to pick stock. Like, they're not going to short Apple or whatever. And so as a result, they used to have stock brokers, investment managers. But now all that money has gotten pushed into the hands of a very small number of institutional investors: BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard. I think it's like four. And the numbers kind of bounce around. But some of the stuff I've seen says they generally control about 80% of the shares that are in the S&P 500. So these four or five companies control 80% of the public capital. That means that, as a practical matter, they are the common owner of every major public company in America, including competitors. So, and this is my longest question. So academics like Eric Posner, who actually came to work for Jonathan Cantor at the Antitrust Division, and Fiona Scott Morton have written that, you know, basically this is something we should be very, very worried about, because and you can see why, right? So if the same two or three asset managers own 15% apiece of United, American Airlines, Delta, and Southwest, that means they want the overall value of the companies to be as high as possible. And it'll give them a direct economic incentive to not want one company, as the free market theory would say they would want to do, cut its prices, kill the rest, increase its market share, and emerge maybe 50% more valuable, but the other three are dead, right? That is not in the interest of the common owner. The common owner wants them all. It's 80%. So that's a very long question. I'm just curious if you've thought about this at all. Obviously, I'm not asking you to opine on any particular case or whatever, but just what do you think about these new, and private equity has similar dynamics where they'll own competitors in a particular city. Is this something you've thought much about?
Let me start off, but before I answer this, you know, like I said at the beginning, I'm here in my individual capacity. I'm not representing the commission.
Yeah, of course.
And so the views I'm expressing are not about the commission and not about any, like, particular matter. So let's set aside, before I answer this, the, like, specific asset managers you identified. I'm not going to talk about them specifically at all. But I do think the principle or the concept you've identified is super important. And I remember reading Einar Elhag's article in 2016, because I, like most Americans, put most of the money I invest in, you know, indexed funds that
ETFs
are run by this.
Yeah, exactly.
Run by these asset managers. It's a, you know, safe place for someone who is not going to play the market. I'm not going to. It's very irrational. It's a safe place to put it. And I remember reading this article going, oh, I never thought about this, like, common ownership or cross ownership problem before at all, much less as an antitrust problem. But Elhag had just talked about this in 2016. And then you're right, you know, Scott Morton and Posner have like written sort of on top of Elhag's work, like, this is a real problem. The commission actually addressed this recently on a thing I voted for. FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, is considering changes to its rules by which it grants waivers for firms to, like, asset manager firms to own stock or own entirely utility companies, which are subject to FERC's regulation. And they are allowed to give waivers to let these asset managers own utility companies, even though they own other companies, including other utility companies. And the FTC unanimously with DOJ wrote a comment letter in this ongoing rulemaking where we highlighted the risk of common and cross ownership. And this is in the 2023 merger guidelines. You know, there are parts of the guidelines that I'm not sure I agree with, but this one I think is important. It makes important points. There are like obvious potential antitrust problems with this common ownership problem. The first is, if you've got one business that owns non-controlling stakes in multiple companies, it's having access, for example, to like competitive information from multiple competitors. That itself is sort of like facially a problem. The second is, even if, and it's what you identified, even if you don't own a controlling stake at any one of these companies, you might own enough for board seats or for other ways to like dictate outcomes to the company, to dictate business decisions. And that is a nasty incentive not to compete on certain things or to diminish the incentive to compete. And if the theory of the antitrust laws and of American competition policy is that basically maximum competition is good, disincentives to sort of compete in order to benefit the common owner are very risky. And so this letter pointed this out, like, hey, even in cases where the acquisition of one of these utilities isn't, you know, a controlling stake, it can still create competitive problems because of the risk of like information share or access to competitive information, the disincentive to compete. And, you know, that problem seems like it may be compounded if, you know, you have a small number of non-controlling shareholders in each company and the identity of those shareholders is all the same. So, you know, one company owning 15% of stock in one company and in a competitor, you know, we would say, hey, this might trigger some antitrust concern, but standing alone, you know, maybe not, it might not be super dangerous. But if there are, you know, five of those and all in the same companies, you know, then you've got, it seems like it compounds the potential antitrust problem that might exist from common ownership generally. So, yes, I mean, I've not done as much thinking as like Fiona or Posner, but yes, like the antitrust merger guidelines address this as a problem. The FTC has just said, like, we should all be wary of the competitive problems that this sort of cross and common ownership can create. And I do think it's a problem. It's an issue, not necessarily a problem, but it is an issue that the enforcers are going to have to confront because this sort of cross ownership, common ownership consolidation is growing, not diminishing.
For sure. And so then I guess I have a related question. This isn't specific to the asset managers, but over the, especially after George Floyd, there were a lot of different alliances to achieve very usually within the umbrella of ESG. So, so you know, the Climate Alliance to reduce carbon, the Racial Justice Alliance. You see, the law firms where they'll all join something to pledge to hire more Black lawyers. I was very surprised when I was in the private sector because I hadn't been in for 5 or 6 years by how monolithic the big companies are on particularly like racialized hiring of vendors and staff. It's really weird. And it's quite overt. Maybe it's gotten a little better after SFFA, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious if you think these kinds of things are the sorts of things that can present an antitrust problem. I mean, they're not colluding to raise prices, but they are colluding to, you know, whatever, produce less carbon, hire people of this race and not that race, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Just in general, not about any specific.
Yeah, I mean, look, and Chair Khan has even addressed this, and either in a speech or a paper, I can't remember which, she said ESG is not a valid justification to collude. And, you know, like some of these ESG agreements, I'm not going to say they're anti-competitive, but I am going to say that they were agreements between competitors about what to do.
That maybe at least could be.
In the markets, that's right.
Depending on all
that's
the
right.
details and facts and law.
That's right,
and,
that's right. And often looked like an agreement not to do certain things. And when horizontal, you know, when firms in a horizontal relationship or competitors agree to do things or not to do things, generally our antitrust laws say we should think about this very carefully. And, you know, the fact that the thing that they might be agreeing on is favored politically by one side or the other is basically irrelevant to the antitrust question about whether it's good for competitors to agree on this type of thing. On the hiring thing, you know, it doesn't come up very much, but labor is a market, and the antitrust laws apply to combinations and conspiracies in any line of commerce. Same with the Clayton Act. So, you know, this is a sort of like roaring debate that we're having within antitrust right now and within the
Biden people have been very forward leaning on labor market restraints, right? They've even brought criminal cases.
That's right.
In a few of them.
That's right. And that actually goes, I mean, the anti-poaching stuff like in Silicon Valley, that goes back to before the Biden administration where
that
they
probably would have been a criminal case today, I bet.
Yeah,
it's the Steve Jobs one about
how we're not gonna hire exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But the point being, even within the sort of bipartisan antitrust consensus, which has frayed over the last 5 years, there was agreement that labor is a market and that if you fix output in that market or prices or whatever, or you allocate markets, which is what the no poaching agreements do, it creates antitrust problems. And, you know, I think the debate about we're having right now within antitrust and, you know, like Commissioner Bedoya, my colleague on the FTC, has written and given speeches a lot about how, you know, labor concerns, including like labor union, like organizing concerns, are antitrust concerns. You know, I don't know how I feel about that, but it's true that labor markets are markets. And if there are anti-competitive agreements among purchasers of labor, whether those agreements have to do with like everyone agreeing on which races are going to be hired or why or the conditions, those aren't, have never been understood to be and aren't outside of like the interests of, or the interests that the antitrust laws are supposed to protect. So, you know, without addressing any of the like specific things, agreements among competitors about who to hire, who not to hire, have always been understood to at least present problems the antitrust laws are concerned with.
So my last question, you've worked in the Senate, you've worked in state government, you're now a Republican commissioner on the FTC. You know, look, there's all this talk about a realignment, about where the Republicans are going to all be like Josh Hawley marching with the union workers. The Democrats, I think the Democrats are already here. They're the neoliberals, you know, hanging out with Sundar Pichai and the Google people and like going to Burning Man like Neil Katyal and all this other, you know, fancy stuff while we're hanging out with the working class. Which I think would mean that in antitrust, you could at least imagine a bit of a role reversal where Chair Kahn and Jonathan Cantor's very forward-leaning perspective is increasingly shared, if not adopted, by our sort of our party. How real do you think this is? And if you had to sort of play things out for the next 10 years, what would you?
So I think that the realignment on the left is pretty real. I don't know sort of...
Meaning they're now the plutocrats.
Well, but also, I think, look, like...
In my words, not yours.
But. 5 years ago, the chair's position, you know, the Senator Warren position on antitrust, they were plucky upstarts that no one in their party took tremendously seriously.
Yeah.
They're now in charge.
Yeah.
And that basically happened overnight. And, I mean, you know, Chair Kahn is younger than I am, and she was... The law review article that sort of, like, put her on the national stage is, like... Seven years old.
It had a great title.
It did.
It's good marketing.
She's
good at marketing.
Yeah. She got it. It's Amazon's antitrust paradox, right?
I think it's just called the Amazon paradox.
Yeah. I mean, it's good.
Yeah.
She got it.
Props
her. Yeah. Seriously. I also agree with you that I think what has been called, and I think with some actually the sort of professional managerial elite are now the like core of that side of the aisle, which makes the left very interesting right now because Kahn's version of antitrust is not consistent with their interests. The way I've described the antitrust debate on the right, on our side of the aisle, is it's a jump ball, and that the fraying of the consensus, the like Borkian consensus, means that on our side, people are like grappling with this for the first time in a long time about whether do we continue with this sort of price and output dominant version of antitrust? Should it account for other things? And I think which side of the court that jump ball lands depends on a lot of things. One, I think this election will partially determine that. If President Trump wins, he's going to need to pick an FTC chair and a AAG for the antitrust division. That they wield a tremendous amount of power over where a party is on antitrust because antitrust is primarily a government-driven thing. So that will determine a lot of it. But the second, and it's sort of the wild card in this, is the judiciary, because everything that the enforcers do is checked by the judiciary. When mergers are blocked, there's a trial, a PI trial or a full trial in front of a judge. When rulemakings are adopted, a judge will decide whether they're lawful. Conduct cases, criminal cases, like your wife handles at DOJ, those are all in front of the judiciary.
Yeah.
No matter where the sort of executive branch is going, on either side or how quickly. It will only go as quickly and to the extent as the slowest moving, most conservative, and I mean small c, in terms of disposition, not politics, branch of the government is, which is the judiciary. and I think this has been talked about a little, but I think both sides sort of overstate either its insignificance or its significance. I think that the folks who want to recover the original consensus say, don't worry, the judiciary is going to take care of this. The folks on the other side say, don't worry, the judiciary will go where we want them. I'm not sure either is correct. And I think on the right, I think that this answer is going to be written by academics and judges who dig into the original meaning of the Sherman and Clayton Acts and try to figure out, did Judge Bork get this correct as we now do originalism? I mean, like it or hate it, a lot of the work that you and I did on judges in the Trump administration was we put people who take originalism incredibly seriously, are in many ways outcome blind. Like, we have our interpretive theory. It must be followed to its conclusion. And we got a lot of scholars who think that way too, largely because we created like a judicial market for it, for this scholarship. I think that there are folks, you know, on the right who are beginning to sort of dig back into the original meaning of the Sherman and Clayton Acts. And to see whether they're consistent with what we today call the consumer welfare standard. And if they aren't, I think judges are going to be more open to embracing other theories of antitrust more quickly than sort of the defenders of the consensus are. But similarly, if this sort of research, which is beginning, reveals that the consensus basically got it right, I think that sort of the revolution that we've seen on the left and the debate we're having on the right is not going to move the way they think it is. And it's going to be in many ways sort of stayed and retained within the consensus if judges think that that is in fact the correct reading of the law.
Yeah, but I mean, so, and I guess that wasn't my last question. But I mean, so look, the law is sort of a, it's sort of a pendulum. And so even it seems to me that there's a plausible case for a more modest aspiration, which is to say, look, you know, Bork was really great, but now we're too far. We've gone too far in that direction. And even on his own terms, we're not dealing with things that are like pretty serious problems. So like I don't know the details of the Apple case, and you should, I'm not asking you about the Apple case, because that is the FTC, right? Or is that DOJ?
DOJ.
It's DOJ. Okay, so maybe, I guess it wouldn't come before you. But like, it just seems to me that there may be, just having more people engaged in thinking creatively as plaintiffs, using the tools that exist right now. Like Alston is a good example. So I was at the court for Alston, the NCAA case, that Seth Waxman, who's a very good lawyer at Wilmer, petitioned. He asked the Supreme Court to hear the case and then lost 9-0.
Right.
You know, that's not normally the way you want it to go. And I thought that was interesting because it showed that, like, people are not thinking that hard these days. And I do wonder if there's a lot of progress we could make sort of toward a deconsolidation by just being more thoughtful about applying the current law the way it's currently understood against new economic arrangements that are dangerous.
Okay. Yeah, so I totally agree with that. And that's a good caveat's not the right word. It's a good corollary to my original answer, which is, you know, there are cases that you could that one could probably win even under the consensus view of antitrust that just aren't brought because of sort of like political views about the political economy by the enforcers. That I think has shifted, and that shift doesn't rely on the judiciary. And I don't think that they are unwilling to sort of accept more aggressive antitrust. I think Alston's a great example. Like, I have a hard time reading Judge Kavanaugh's concurrence in Alston and think like, this is not a court that is not willing to find in favor of antitrust.
The unanimous majority opinion was the better.
It was phenomenal. It was very good. It was absolutely correct. But the example,
no, for sure, BK was hot.
Yeah, and in a way that I think, if you get back to the 90s, you would be surprised to find a Republican judge like him saying this type of thing about antitrust cases. Another example is Google, United States and Virginia against Google. The theory, so this is a case that Virginia.
Which you signed the complaint, right?
I did. Yeah. It represented 17 states alongside the United States and argued the transfer motion that kept it in the Eastern District of Virginia. We aren't proposing.
Were they trying to go to San Francisco?
They're trying to go to EDNY where the MDL was so that we would hear about the case in a decade.
Yeah.
Good work. Thank you. We weren't proposing a novel theory. It was a like relatively run-of-the-mine consolidation theory premised largely on like tying and a series of acquisitions that had entrenched a monopoly unlawfully and that needed to be unwound. But it wasn't like, this wasn't an envelope pushing Section 2 theory in the theory, in the sense that we were like, we need to move you beyond Bork to get this. Sure. We were like, just take the consensus, this is illegal. The difference is, I think that the worries about consolidation on both sides of the aisle lead enforcers, even if they share the consensus view, to be more willing to pull the trigger in cases they would have looked at before and exercise sort of a prudential judgment against bringing, not because they thought it was inconsistent with the antitrust laws, but for sort of like broader political economy concerns. That, I think, that's probably here to stay. I mean, Attorney General Meares is very conservative, and there were other Republican states joining Merrick Garland and the Justice Department suing Google on a monopolization claim that would require them to sell off parts of their business. This doesn't sound like 90s-style Republican antitrust policy, but I agree with you. There's a lot that can be done to protect Americans from consolidation with existing theories of antitrust that don't require a revolution, and I agree with you, and I think Alston is like the perfect example. It's not like judges are going to be like, no, we have policy concerns with aggressive antitrust enforcement, and so we are going to like police the consensus and keep stuff that comes close to the edge from getting in. I think that they're willing to do it, but I think they're willing to do it not because of the like consolidation concerns that so many Americans have, but more because they're like, we're just reading the law and this is not inconsistent with the law. The fact that enforcers were exercising their judgment not to bring the cases basically for like non-legal or soft legal reasons. You're right. I think there's a lot can be done, and the judiciary is not going to be unreceptive.
That's great. All right, well, thank you.
Thank you for listening to Open Minds, a Freedom of Thought podcast series interviewing the people who bring courage and independent thought to the challenges of today. To learn more, visit freedomofthought.fedsoc.org.